Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature and the College of Arts and Sciences. Our speaker is Suffolk University Assistant Professor George Kalogeras. Professor Kalogeras' lecture is titled Dialogos, Paired Poems in Translation. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature Assistant Professor Margaret Litvin.
We're very happy to have with us George Kalogeras, the author most recently of this book, Dialogos, Paired Poems in Translation. It came out from Antilever in 2012 with a foreword by Rosanna Warren and a commentary by David Ferry. George's interest in poetry and translation goes back, as he has written. Among other places, it goes back to a childhood Greek class. As an elementary school student learning Greek after school, he was taught from a textbook of simplified vignettes from Homer's Iliad. As he has written, quote, "One of the similes described the contending Argive and Trojan armies as being like stones on a seashore washed over by a wave. In Winthrop, Massachusetts, where I grew up, the ocean was at the end of my street. Walking by the waves, as the waves raked over the stones of the shore, I could hear the clattering sounds of shields, and I could see how the stones with each successive wave moved barely a few inches back and forth like armies in stalemate. Even the foam of the surf was like the manes of the horses or the plumes of the helmets. Each time I heard the rhythm of the Atlantic's breaking current, the sound washed over me, and I was reminded of the movement of the language in the simile." George went on to study poetry and become a BU alumnus twice over, earning an MFA in poetry here, studying with Derek Walcott, among other people, and then a PhD in comparative literature from the University Professors Program right here on this hall. He has published a book of poems based on the life and notebooks of Albert Camus, Camus Carnet, came out in 2006. His translation of George Seferis' book, Three Secret Poems, appeared as a special feature in Harvard Review with introductions by David Ferry and David Ricks. His translation of Seferis' book-length poem, Thrush, appeared as a special in a special feature in Fulcrum. He's recently completed a manuscript of poems and translations called Guide to Greece, which utilizes material from the prose travelogues of Pausanias, particularly as that second century AD work is concerned with Arcadia and Sparta, places which connect to familial places of origin for Kalogeras. The book he'll be speaking about today is called Dialogos, as I said, Paired Poems in Translation. It includes but goes well beyond the Greek tradition. This ingenious and deeply personal, somehow, book gathers and juxtaposes 12 pairs of poems ranging across Greek, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, French, Russian, German, and circling back to Latin. Borges sits down with Cavafy. Rilke converses with Sappho. Baudelaire slant rhymes with Mandelstam, and so on. And I'm going to quote a little bit of Rosanna Warren's foreword. She says, "Kalogeras' achievement in style might be seen as resembling Robert Lowell's in Imitations, but it stands in diametric opposition to that work. Lowell roughed up and ironed out the poems he translated so that they all, Sappho, Baudelaire, Montale, became train lines to the grand central station of Lowell's massive and dramatic personality. The lover of Lowell rejoices. The lover of Sappho or Baudelaire mourns or winces or grins and bears it. By stepping behind his paired poets, Kalogeras doesn't precisely vanish, since he remains as a tone of voice, as a moral lens defining the focus of the whole. But he throws the emphasis away from the personality of the translator and onto the mysterious atemporal unity of imagination the pairings propose. The effect is startling, revelatory." With that, please join me in welcoming George Kalogeras.
Thanks so much. That's beautiful. I'm going to be talking about my book, Dialogos, which means through the language. And there are 12 pairings of poems, and the poems, as Margaret was mentioning, the book is meant to put the chosen poems into conversation with each other. I'm not a professional translator. I'm not a linguist. There's one language in that book that I know nothing of, and that's Hungarian. But I always worked closely with people who did know the language, if I didn't. And they were always poems that had been with me for a long time. And maybe that's the personal element you were thinking about. And I think implicit within the idea of the book is the sense that a writer's voice is always a register of different voices, different conversations going along as you're writing. Okay, I'm going to give you a sense of what I do through a reading of translations and my poems. And then I'm going to go into one or two of the pairings closely. I'll go into the Greek of Kavafi. But I want to start with the reading. I'm going to start with the Pessoa poem. This poem was I had a co-translator, and her name is Glaucia Rezende. She's a Brazilian poet and translator. Aniversario, birthday. And it's on way back when my birthday was something to celebrate, and no one I knew had died, I was quite happy. Happy my birthday belonged to the customs of the house where I grew up, an old house that preserved ancestral traditions. But what really made the day so special, so sacred, was the joy that everyone felt, including me. Back when birthdays were something to celebrate, those days when I was a perfectly healthy child, healthy because I didn't suspect a thing about what was really happening. And when I looked in my parents' eyes, I saw myself reflected there, just as I was back then, when our knowing looks were a sign of intelligence. Back in those days, when I didn't have to think about what others expected, but simply assumed that I was already the one I thought I would be, they thought I would be. I had no need of hopes. I slept quite well. And since I didn't need hopes, I didn't know how to hope when I began to try to, hope to, make sense out of my life. It all seemed hopeless to me. Of course, that person I was, I know was me, someone with a throbbing heart and a vibrant family, one of a group that spent their evenings talking to one another, like country folk huddled by a fire. It's all so far away now, I can barely catch a flicker of what they said. But I was a child of that world, a world that loved me. Why wasn't I able to see this back then, before I became, good God, the person I am today? Tonight, it's all too clear. As far back as that narrow back hall extended, there was always a loose, damp section of wallpaper, green with mildew, around the baseboard, about to tear away. Like days of those months that seemed to take forever, before each page on the kitchen calendar was finally peeled away. Now my walls are bare. At the end of the day, trembling through my tears, I feel even less substantial than stagnant air in a hazy hallway. I'm the door that opened reluctantly on the day the deal was closed and the house was sold, still shadowing the threshold where, one by one, the others passed into night. Back in the days before my years were spent like smoldering wicks on a cake, my face aglow as I made my birthday wish to the birthday candles before I blew them all out with a single breath. Back in the days that none of my poems can rekindle, those days that I still love, the only days I ever felt like a normal human being. And as long as those flights of longing persist, I still go running back down the stairs of a two-storied house, while running up the stairs is the boy I was, who gives me this look that's neither here nor there. When I'm dining alone, I sometimes could swear the extra place settings are still in place, as if those doilies of gossamer memory were set on solid mahogany, where everything's bright as an emblem, emblazoned on monogram napkins. The summer fruit suspended by the sideboard's wings. My aunts carrying their trays of pastry covered in tinfoil. The cupboard's dark, delicious mysteries unveiled. Until the polished silverware dulls. And then the present looks tarnished in light of those days. Why can't I devour my hunger for the past the way it devoured each day, buttering me up like a slice of toast, but without the awful taste of sourdough when it sticks between the teeth? And now my heart, stop it, is thumping so hard I can hardly breathe. If only thinking could stay hermetically sealed in the head. Oh my God, all my birthdays have passed and I'm still here. No matter how you check off the days, I'm afraid they all add up to this. The party's over. Would that I could have kept their passing gleam, God damn it, and carried it in my pocket, wrapped in a handkerchief. Bright crumb to carry me back to those days when my birthday was something to celebrate. You know, there's so much of Pessoa's bemused, hapless, kind of brilliant crystallizations of uncongealed time that I couldn't get at. But I was pleased with the phrase, neither here nor there. And I was very grateful for David Ferry's introduction, and I want to read something that he wrote about that phrase, because I think it says something about the way the idiom works, and it's worth noting. The boy he used to be runs up the stairs past him, giving him a look that was neither here nor there. The idiom for indifference, a kind of verbal shrug. And at the same time, not here on the site of longing, nor there, back there in the past of his identity, and also neither here nor there, somehow in the mind of his longing, in both places, both times, at once, and not locatable in either. Another thing about this poem, when I was translating it, and I was showing it to my Brazilian friend who was going over the Portuguese, and she said, there's no aunts carrying trays of pastry in the poem. And I said, I know, they're my aunts. And she laughed, and she understood it. And I think I can defend that, because I think that, and I put a note in the book about that, but I think that sometimes your own experience contributes to the sort of remembered force that's in the language, which becomes the remembered force of the poem. So an extrapolation. I want to go on to the poem by Mandelstam. Okay, Mandelstam, of course, who died in the Soviet Gulag. As I was washing myself in the dark, washing outside where the ice-cold water kept spilling over the rim of the barrel, the evening stars against the horizon glistened like salt on the blade of an axe. As I was washing myself in the dark, I saw the locked gate that couldn't keep out the menacing look of my surroundings once it had entered my state of mind. Soon the weavers will weave a new pattern from anything they can get their hands on, looming there in the near future. No matter what fabric they happen to stitch, I don't think the seams will ever be finer than a single line of honest speech. Salt of the earth and stars of the sky, dissolving now in the water's reflection, this briny water that keeps turning blacker like some purer shade of appalling death. As if our lips had already tasted what's steeped in the salt of worsening luck, as I was washing myself in the dark, washing outside where the ice-cold water kept spilling over the rim of the barrel. The earth edged closer to truth and terror. There's something that so intrigued me in the way that Mandelstam could enact entrapment with such felicity and wretchedness at the same time. I want to read one of my own poems now, because it involves a line from that Mandelstam. There's a number of modern Greek poets that are mentioned in this poem. Some of them you probably know, of course, Kavafi and Sepharis. Others you might not know. I don't think you have to know them. I think they're sort of literary types. And the poem this goes back in a way to the Pessoa poem. One of my reasons for starting with the Pessoa poem is that, I wanted to sort of make it one of my own family poems, and I have a number of poems about my family. And this poem certainly is one. It's about my parents who had a grocery store, and they knew really very little about literature, but they were sort of thought of themselves as critics. you can tell how little they knew when I read the first line of the poem. And the poem is called Ambassador of the Dead. My parents were never crazy about Kavafi. They didn't know much about poetry at all, and barely had time to read anything but the papers. Though sometimes a poem they liked would appear in their beloved Hellenic voice, a poem that was always in rhyming stanzas and deeply nostalgic. Or else I'd show them one of the modern Greek poets that I was trying to translate and ask for their advice about a line. "Is this for school?" they'd say. My parents were never crazy about Kavafi. To them, he was too refined, too Alexandrian, and they were only peasants, Choriates. And there was no Ithaca for them to go back to. When I'd beg them to read the Greek, they'd balk when they got to his purest Katharevous diction. They just couldn't stomach its formalist starch. His poems were never demotic enough, never trapezica, songs to be sung across the kitchen table. And if I read them elitis, Odysseus Olytis, too, was too elitist to trust, too drunk on the island sun of his own Ionian vision, to people for whom elevation meant being raised in the steepening shadows of Peloponnesos. "The great Odysseus," my father would chide. And if Yanis Ritsos spoke their working-class language and his poems weren't hard to follow, still, once they heard that Ritsos was Marxist, that's all they needed to know. "But read us some more Seferi," I hear them say as I sit and write at a green formica table, the same one where we sat together and ate in another century. Was it Mandelstam who said that poetry to him was bread from the kitchen table, but that his words were dead if he tried to start a poem by looking up at the stars? Osip Mandelstam, who wrote, "The evening stars against the horizon glisten like salt on the blade of an axe." I think my parents would have liked that verse and called it trapezica. Saying that, their shades appear in the table's reflection, looking up as if they were thirsting for something to drink. "Read us some more Seferi, noblesse oblige Seferiades," that haughty diplomat who, in his British banker suits, had seen the world. French symbolist figs and Earl Grey with Eliot, and stones too heavy to lift without his learning. but also deep silence as old Europe explodes, and crowded refugee ships as a form of transport. Ambassador of the high modernist, ancient dead. Read us that one about Stratis. You know, Stratis thalassinos. I hear my parents in tone. Their voices, as soft as the hiss of the surf in Sepphoris, calling from the floor of the Dead Sea, though the smooth formica shines green as the placid Aegean of poems. And then my mother returns to her ironing board, the steam iron dipping like a prow that's driving through choppy waves, the pile of freshly laundered butcher's aprons, as white as whitewashed Piraeus. And now my father's back at his block, still reading the smoking entrails. He has turned the victim's head so that its eyes are facing Erebus or Smyrna. I'm spreading sawdust and watching it soak up the blood. I want to read Radnati's eclogue, seventh eclogue. Radnati died in a Nazi work camp very close to the end of the war. Before I read the poem, I want to read the note to the poem. When Radnati's corpse was exhumed 20 months after his execution, this poem was found transcribed in an address book left in his raincoat pocket. Seventh eclogue. Observe how the evening does it. Approaching the barbed wire so deftly, it slips through the loopholes unscathed. Watch how the breathless air encloses the oak stockades until everything that surrounds us now appears as weightless and dark as the darkness in the air surrounding the barracks. See how the stillness extends the tension till even the mind's unflinching eye recoils from the barbed wire. See? Feast your eyes on my fantasy, love. It's the only way out of this prison and the only way I can reach you. Our dreams are still the beautiful angel that comes with her key to the walls where we sleep in fear, tossing and turning until she turns the lock on our reverie, releasing us from the darker cell of unrelenting pain. Free for now, we fly from this broken flesh, my fellow inmates and I, as if we were headed for home, with our shaved heads still flat on the bunks. Uplifted by the breath of their loud snoring, their sunken breasts puffed up with a homing pigeon's pride, I dream my companions are already far from Serbia's peaks, flying on instinct, as if they knew their obscure provinces still exist, somewhere beyond those blinding drifts, but only in memory. Obscure indeed. Are the homes we left still standing? The ones we so often describe in our letters at home, even as the bombs are falling? The groans all sound the same when I close my eyes. But who can predict if the man on my left or the man on my right will wake to see his home intact? And is there a home for the poem with stately measure, a place where people still love to recite hexameter lines by heart, given the state we're in? Concentrate on the line, a line that bears its leveling pain without the slash of accent marks. Call it a lifeline, inching along the page like a slug in the dark, but not so dark that you don't pick up the gleam of its slime, if the mind's glow is steady as a searchlight. Concentrate on Homer's meter as the line squiggles blind as an earthworm. Here where the bunks are crawling with lice and rumors fly, the mail never comes, though every evening the fog arrives at our doorstep, enveloping us as if the vague, unsettling certainty of where we are is the air we breathe. And once the guards confiscate our flashlights and books, an inmate's only source of illumination remains the stark fact that we're all in the dark together. And if the heavy mountain mist never lifts from our foreheads, except in feverish dreams, those dreams are all the same. The same for the partisan Serb, unruly Italian, despondent Jew. All of them waiting to hear what they hear in a woman's voice saying, "It's over." As if ravaged limbs rekindled at dusk, when honeyed light prolongs their naked longing. For what? A miracle? It's over. Now the night is falling fast, which means we have survived another day, and another day of life is lost. Now the sleepers might as well be dead to the world. The camp is so quiet. The moon brightens the barbed wire, as if to keep my line of vision focused on the valley that stands between us. What passes for talk now passes between those sentries whose shadows pace the walls. Tomorrow morning, the lice will be swarming over our skin, as if sunrise signaled them to begin sucking our blood. But still for now, not a single night moth flutters as softly as the sallow eyelids of my sleeping companions. One of them lies face down on the narrow bunk. He grunts and then turns over. Wedged between bodies, his face reflects the moonlight. Worms have eaten holes through the wood where we curl up like larvae. Look, can you see me, love, in the flare I draw from my cigarette stub? Tonight it's too dark for a dream to keep my vigilant lips from tasting the crumbling ash at the end of the line. Tonight I can't sleep, and when I open my mouth, nothing comes out but a trembling ring of smoke that evokes your kiss. Tonight it's too dark to face another day without you. I used a hexameter, tetrameter, 6 foot and 4 foot line. And in that line, where I wanted to convey something of the sense of the worm inching its way across the page, but it starts with an anapestic first foot, so that the stress is on the third syllable, and then trochaic, trochaic, and it ends on an overstressed feminine ending. It ends on worm, so that the line itself is sort of, pushing to its full extremity, and there's the voice is in extremis. And I think for a second, you don't know how to read squiggles. There's a sort of spasmodic conjunction there. You don't know whether it's verb or adjective until the syntax sort of elongates itself again. So that was one of the effects. That's not in the original. I mean, I'll read the original, which stays very close, and it's a very beautiful translation by Ben Turner. And thus, in darkness, I feel my way over the poem, shorn of its crown of accents. Even so do I live blind like an inchworm. So it's more feel my way would be the literal. But I wanted it more to enact that kind of blind wildness in a way. I want to move to some of the Greek material that I have, and I'm going to read one of my own poems first, and then I'll read Cavafis' poem, The Trojans. The poem I'm going to read is called Odysseus Seeing Laertes. Towards the end of the Odyssey, when Odysseus comes home, and he comes home in disguise, and he's grown old, he sees his father, and his father's working on trees, pruning trees, and they're trees that the father and son had planted and pruned when Odysseus was a child. So Odysseus seeing Laertes. It's getting dark, and he's still in the yard. By now, she'd be stewing over the steamy cazzaroles she has to reheat, but glad that he's finally home. He's inspecting his favorite tree, the sour quince. All day, he's been hacking away at carcasses of frozen chickens, piled up on his chopping block, like little hecatombs of smoking entrails. The sour quince has put forth pink and white petals, like the flakes of sawdust stuck to his blood-stained work boots. As when I was a boy, standing away from the shade, and he would turn and see me and call me over, singing from the trees that line from the swallow song. Come here, little bird. Come here. Come here. Don't go. I want to read Cavafy's The Trojans, and then I'm going to talk in detail about that particular poem. I'm going to read some material that I brought, but I think I'll read the poem first. And the handout, I have my version, Keeley and Sherard's version, mainly so you can see a closer version, and the Greek. Cavafy is talking in this poem about a moment in the Iliad when Hector finds himself alone outside of the walls. Well, he doesn't know he's alone. He thinks Deiphobus is with him. And he's facing Achilles, and he turns, and Deiphobus dissolves in a mist, and he knows the gods are against him. The Trojans. As long as our efforts, no matter how hard we try, are doomed to fail, we're like the people of Troy. Just when the tide is finally turning for us and our confidence swells, as if we were ready to face whatever comes our way, Achilles turns up, shouting bloody murder, and crushes our hope with one swift leap from the trench. We're like the Trojans. No matter what we do, this always happens. Though right to the very end, we still believe, we still might win, if only by being brave and not giving in. But once we go out to meet our fate, behind our back it bolts the gate. Even at the 11th hour, we truly believe the gods are with us, defending Troy. But as soon as we resolve to make a stand, that daring spirit dissolves like a phantom friend. Now it's our worst nightmare, but there we are, outside the city walls, running for dear life as the sweat pours down, though our legs feel frozen. Already it's time to start the lamentation. And then, high up on the ancient parapets, Priam and Hecuba weep, weeping for us. I'm going to be talking about, particularly about reasons why I put it into rhyming couplets. And the clue was given to me by those first two lines, Siphorias menon en ton troon. And I'll talk about this in the bit I'm going to read. Although Cavafy's poem is not written in iambic pentameter, rhyming couplets, I chose to translate in that form because it was in that form that I could best hear it as a poem in English. The opportunity to use couplets was suggested to me by the opening lines, which are written in a distinct iambic rhythm, and although they contained only a faint indication of end rhyme, there was still enough of a chime for me to hear the possibility of making something of it. That is, particularly in the way that rhyming couplets, as a form of oral closure, might be used to enact the poem's starkly bemused depiction of intensifying entrapment. In the Greek, the faint chime occurs between the phrase prone to disaster, ton siphorias menon, and the phrase for the Trojans, ton troon. Since neither phrase stresses the last syllable on, the echo is at best an off-rhyme. But even so, in the Greek, one can't help hearing it repeated in the internal and perhaps witty full rhyme of the and Trojans, ton, tron. I say witty because of the lugubrious way the phrase tolls on the tongue, ton, tron, and the way it sounds the thud of a dull and maybe even implacably dumb sardonic note being struck when it occurs again a few lines later in the poem, ton, tron, tolling us back to ton siphodias menon. As if just being Trojan must naturally rhyme with whatever disaster happens to happen to them time and again. And now I'll quote some lines. As long as our efforts, no matter how hard we try, are doomed to fail, we're like the people of Troy. And a few lines later, we're like the Trojans. No matter what we do, this always happens. My fascination with this poem lies in its double sense of dire, inexorable entrapment, and helpless, comic futility. That is, in the ways in which it places us as readers outside the walls with Hector, running for dear life from bloody Achilles, but also in the midst of our common and commonly disheartening daily defeats, face to face with our own intractable failures. The problem for me in my rendering was how to make this tragico-comico effect an intrinsic part of the poem's structure, to get it into the movements of the lines so that the English grammar might take the musical strain of the Greek without showing the linguistic strain of translation. And to do this, I tried to make each couplet speak the feelingly way we speak, keeping them tight enough to contain something of both the Trojans' entrapment and their futile need to resist it, the doggedly foolhardy and the absurdly heroic. The Trojans, who just don't get it, still taking a stand against the indomitable happenstance they can't ever, can't see they will never withstand. I was hoping to capture something of this conjunction of helplessness and haplessness and the opening rhyme of Troy with try, which calls attention to the pathetic closeness of these two conditions by the closeness of the sound of the words themselves, separated by the admission of one vowel. A little later in the poem, when the Trojans are again utterly baffled by events, there is a similar effect in the rhyme of truly with Troy. Since modern Greek is an inflected language, its capacity for generating rhymes is abundantly available. Some of Cavafy's internal rhymes, and there are a lot of internal rhymes in this poem, are no doubt unintentional, but others are clearly meant to be registered as vital to the voice of the poem, whose central concern is for doomed Hector, as in the proximate placement and combined force of the words for boldness. These words are all in the fourth stanza, third stanza. Toll me, spirit, psyche, walls, tiki, and running away, fiyi. I knew I could not reproduce in English the devastating implications of these disyllabic words, so tightly entangled in the dark linguistic knot of their fatal nexus. But I tried to imply a similar kind of inescapable pressure through a tight set of multiple rhymes and dense alliteration in the following couplet. But once we go out to meet our fate, behind our back, it bolts the gate. Here I wanted the gate to lock inexorably shut, not only in the end rhyme of meet and gate, or in the definitive, maybe even overstressed way, the monosyllabic words are meant to draw the meter to an exaggerated close. But to reinforce this effect at the start of the second verse, where fate and gate might serve to clinch the knowledge that Hector and his allotted length of thread have reached the end of their line. I use a different internal rhyme a few lines later when Hector turns to the friend and fellow warrior he thinks is there and who, as Homer tells us in Book 22 of the Iliad is suddenly not gone like an evaporating mist. But as soon as we resolve to make a stand, that daring spirit dissolves like a phantom friend. Although Cavafy does not specifically mention this incident, the Iliadic scene is directly alluded to by the details of his poem. And for his Greek audience in particular, there would be no need for spelling out this connection. I think you could even add to that for his British Hellenist audience, because he was so well connected with Forster and other very knowledgeable classical writers and readers. And that was part of that Alexandrian world that he was writing in. That's part of the reason why I kind of filled the poem out to add some of those details, which would have been understood right away, with no need to for the particulars. So, too, I felt that my experience of translating Cavafy's poem was also an experience of reading my way back into Homer's poem, and that my own translation should, in turn, be read with these transactions in mind. My intention in this couplet was to have resolve and dissolves do at the catch in the breath at the middle of the line, what the end of the couplet would then confirm with a full stop rhyme. Hector's exposed aloneness, which is, by implication, our own vulnerability as well, when we're struck by misfortune and feel there's nowhere to turn. This kind of desperate isolation, the feeling of being abandoned by the gods and by those who are dear to us, is a condition Cavafy's verse is deeply alive to, and which he conveys simply and profoundly in his elegant cadences, and with his now famous kind of lucidly dry, sublimely plain-spoken intonations, registers that go well beyond my rendering. Cavafy says that Hector is paralyzed, parali, but I chose here too to unpack the Greek term, still palpably redolent with the dreadful Homeric scene it draws on. As Hector is being chased around the walls by Achilles, the horror of it breathing down his neck, and as the sweat is running down his legs, at the same time he's frozen with fear. It is a state, Homer says, that is not unlike the paralysis one feels in nightmares, that feeling of being chased but unable to get away from your pursuer, no matter how hard you try, caught in the grip of cataleptic panic. I wanted to get that in, and so doing, to make the poem more personal, and the way that Homer's simile and Cavafy's allusion to it feel so personal. Personal in that awful sense of feeling both petrified and, because Hector is being watched from the walls, deeply ashamed. Finally, there's the concluding couplet with its more distant suggestion of polysyllabic rhyme, parapets and weeping for us. Suddenly, Priam and Hecuba appear, the great king and the great queen, who are now our parents as well, crying over our mournful circumstance. Boon losers, that our mortality ensures we always are, and as the Trojans always are. Priam and Hecuba, crying down from the city walls that could not protect us. From high up on the parapets of poetry, where they're forever steeped in sorrow, sorrow for Hector, the best of the Trojans, and whose doomed magnificence is also now ours by sympathetic proxy, thanks to the generous energies of Cavafy's art. Our parents, helpless to help, hapless us. The disaster that Cavafy's masterful voice keeps reminding us can never be mastered, even as the exacting movement of his verse keeps expressing the joy of having made something exciting out of it. I think what I'd like to do is just read the 9 lines of the Greek. Troes, ini prospathies mas ton syphorias menon, ini prospathies mas san ton troon, komati katothonume, komati penum epanumas, ke archisume nachume tharos, ke kales elpides, ma panda kati vieni, ke mas stamata, o achilevstin tafron, embrostamas, Vieni che me fornes megalas, mastromasi, ini praspathiesmas, santo troon. Further down on the second line from the bottom, you can see the first two Greek words, ton imeron. He actually gets the rhyme in again, but I couldn't use that because my translation, I did something different with that line. But it's the verse is redolent with that, I think, with that rhyme. I think to give you a sense of the book, what I'd like to do is to read the poem that's paired with the Cavafy poem, which is a poem by Borges, to a minor poet of the Greek anthology. Where are they now, those days that belong to you, when you were here on earth? Passing days into a mind, shuttling between their joys and sorrows, as if they displayed a pattern of the cosmos that you would weave with your own words someday. Between the smooth clay banks of time, the current surge hasn't carried a single verse of yours back down to us. Your name survives as a footnote, salvaged from the numbered flow of years by a dense appendix. For you, there are no inscriptions carved in shining marble, no grave profile staring back from medallions, and not one scholar scrupulous enough to record the living trace of your legacy. As long as the gods have chosen to bestow on others that brilliance that never fades, you'll be left in the dark forever, dear friend. And given that dark, what more can we say, really, except that once you heard the nightingale singing? But even now, obscured by the growing shadow of the asphodels, your shade must stir a little against the inattentiveness of the gods, your shade and its silenced pride. But as long as the days add up to nothing more than a tangled web of the usual troubles, how could the gods have given you any greater blessing? You who are now the very substance of oblivion, the ash out of which nothing rises. The gods have cast their aura around the foreheads of others, minds whose vast, unyielding powers of illumination expose the heart of each mystery they encounter, which means they're bound to reveal each flower in the rose they hold sacred, until the blaze of their greater ardor for glory destroys it, petal by flaming petal. The gods have treated you more tenderly, brother. For an evening that will never get any darker, you can listen to the nightingale of Theocritus, and nothing there will ever disturb your rapture. Just one thing about this poem that... That's always appealed to me is the sense that it's, you know, on the one hand, it's saying, sort of showing great pity for this poet who's never going to be remembered. And Borges is saying, I'm your brother, I'm experiencing the same fate. And yet, the poem clearly knows that it's not going to be forgotten. I mean, the poem clearly knows it's not one of those minor poets. And there's a nice shift of register there. Okay, I'm going to finish with one last Greek poem. I'm going to read a poem by Sappho. Recently there were some new Sappho poems that were discovered. Very exciting. It's not in the handout, but this was, up until now, the most recent Sappho. It's fragment 58. Crave the freshness of that scent when the muse is so close. Her breasts are open blossoms. And no matter how many years it takes you to master the difficult chords of the tortoise shell, learning to play those melodies clearly will keep your promise in tune with her lovely gift. Like you, I was slender and dark as a lyre. Then time plucked a string and my hair was silver. Once the weight on my heart would lift when the sun came up, now the morning light makes it heavier, and my legs are so weak, it's an effort to stand. though in my day I could dance like a leaping fawn. Now it's the climax of growing old that makes me shudder and groan. But what can you do? We're only human. We can't live forever the way the gods do. And if we could, who can forget the myth of Tithonus? A young man, so gorgeous, a goddess stole him away. Over the horizon, carried off in Aurora's rosy embrace, herself in the grip of Eros. Even Tithonus couldn't fend off time's groping hands, and soon his hoary beard appalled Aurora. Beyond the clouds and their bedroom chamber, it finally dawned on her. Her husband was human. Okay, I'll stop there. Thanks a lot.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Suffolk University Assistant Professor George Kalogeras. Professor Kalogeras' lecture was titled Dialogos, Paired Poems in Translation, and was presented by the Boston University Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature and the College of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's moderator was Department of Modern Languages and Comparative Literature Assistant Professor Margaret Litvin. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Marquise Neal. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.